Welcome to day two of our conversation with Leanne Renee Heber and Andrea James on a haunted history of invisible women. Another thing I wanted to touch on here, and I want to go back to some of the stories, but I know there's some Titanic connection with you guys and the ghosts of the Titanic tour. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. I'm like quasi-obsessed with Titanic. I thought I was obsessed, and then I met actual Titanic obsessives, and I was like, wow, you guys are in it to win it.
Sure.
Oh, they're fantastic. They're amazing. I personally, it's funny because I remember like people posting that photo in the Facebook group and freaking out, and people that were in defense of it were like, what, too soon? And some people were like, yes. So it's that fine line again, right? Mm-hmm. The fine line. I find that story so haunting and so compelling. And like, yeah, I'm right there with James Cameron, man. Like, I can't get enough Titanic. And being New Yorkers, there's so many connections between the ship of dreams and our city. And I'm just, Put me firmly in the yes column there. I will never get jaded or sick of that vessel ever.
And if you're in New York City, you can sign up for a Ghost of the Titanic tour, because there are Titanic connections, especially around in the spring. There are ghost stories that directly relate to people who, you know, spirits who came to shore, even though their bodies were lost at sea. And there's a great deal of lore about that. And it's just, you know, the haunting parallel that the Lusitania left from the same pier that the Titanic was supposed to come in from. Mm-hmm. So you've got two wild ship stories, that, you know, had ill-fated, ends. And so there's a lot,
it's very Final Destination.
Yeah, it really is. It's very, very, very spooky to think about. So,
well, Benjamin Guggenheim, it wasn't Benjamin Guggenheim. I have to look it up. It wasn't him. It was like, there was some other guy, some other wealthy New Yorker who was, he survived Titanic and then he got on the Lusitania.
Yeah.
There's a lot of bizarre twists and turns with Titanic. It's one of those things I've been obsessed with since I was, and I wouldn't say obsessed. When I was young, I was obsessed. But from the age of like five, all of my projects in grade school were drawing the Titanic, were putting Titanic things together with construction paper. And this is very pre the movie. This is like 1988.
Amazing.
So I had that, I don't know, I had a drive and an interest to it from such a young age, getting all the books I could about Titanic. And then of course the movie comes out. But I always like to say it's more of a pure interest. There's nothing to do with the movie. But it's very fascinating. The gravity of what that story is. And I can see why people are horrified by a Titanic bounce house. Mary Stewart was executed in Washington, D.C. for her role in the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. And sightings of her ghost began shortly after her execution. Is that correct? I know you talk about it in the book.
Yes. Sorry. I just was like in my Google Drive just now. It was Alfred Gwynne Vanderbilt.
Oh, on Titanic. Okay.
He did not go on the Titanic because his mother said so many things can go wrong on a maiden voyage. And she meant like, you know, go wrong with the service, the quality of service. Like somebody might get a soup spoon.
You might get the veal.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So he didn't go. He wanted to like let the ship get her reps in. So he didn't go. And then he took the Lusitania. And did not survive.
Wow.
Anyway, sorry. Yeah, there's such a Venn diagram overlap between Titanic people and ghost people. And also, speaking of my childhood favorite books, Ghosts I Have Been by Richard Peck has a Titanic ghost. And that was lodged in my subconscious probably when I started writing the Ghosts of the Titanic tour. Also, my nephew is obsessed with Titanic and obsessed with ghosts. And the number one reincarnation or past life narrative that children will say to their elders, you know, is Titanic related. Like they will all say that was the ship that I was on.
How interesting. I've been told.
Possibly it's the only one they know.
I've been told by my guests on the show that were psychic mediums and such that I had been on Titanic as well. And somebody gave me a name, and then all the audience started Googling it and looking it up. And there's like, nobody's on that list with that name. But no, since we're on it, and one more quick note before we go to Mary Stewart. In my house, this is how much I love it. I actually have a floor tile from Olympic that I had gotten at an auction, and I have it in a little framed box in my living room. And it's very neat. It's very neat to, you know, have it because they were identical to Titanic's.
Yeah. Your white star. Anyway, so you asked about Mary Surratt.
Yes.
It's funny because when she was on trial and when she was being executed, people were like, boo, she's the worst. She's a monster. And then as soon as she died, they were like, oh no, she was the last vestige of white Southern womanhood and she should be venerated. And oh my goodness, we've made a terrible mistake. And that's basically the sort of thought process. So immediately they were like, I suppose did the guilt eclipsed everything else. And then they were like haunted by her specter. So, you know, that's a psychological explanation. I think the literal explanation is just, it was a shocking thing to see a woman hang. And if you see the photographs from that day, they are still really jarring. Like to this day, to see that woman in her widow's weeds on the scaffolding on the gallows, I guess, with those nooses hanging down. It's completely bonkers. So I think people were just really sort of shocked by that spectacle and by the realization that, oh, wow, like they really did it. They really killed her. So, of course, immediately her ghost starts popping up. And my favorite one is this really bizarre account where they talk about her ghost walking in a path and melting the snow on the path where she walks. And it's such an amazing image. But yeah, she's really just this kind of like specter of guilt. You know, she did a bad thing. And it's her and John Wilkes Booth are just kind of like condemned forever. They're just condemned to wander the earth.
Well, and there's cases in which our book discusses romanticizing ghosts and how some of these people would be romanticized after their death. And in a case where someone maybe just led a tragic life, the romanticization doesn't have a problematic aspect. When you're talking about a woman who absolutely conspired to kill Abraham Lincoln, that romanticizing her becomes problematic and sort of, you know, takes the teeth out of the true problems of romanticizing Confederate things, because that is a very, very loaded thing.
Yeah.
And does not contribute really to national healing in any way, shape, or form. So, you know, we try to discuss the things that can be sort of read both ways, but when someone was just a bad person and did bad things, we do not romanticize those bad things, even if their ghost stories have romanticized them. We try to be very clear about that. In that regard, there is a bit of editorializing that we will go forward because we don't want folks to sort of think that we're trying to rehabilitate the images of truly bad people. And women can be bad people just as much as anybody else. So,
yeah, but without a doubt, there's obviously far more to discuss here, and a few more elements I want to talk about. This one is kind of fun. Joan Rivers, she always claims she had a haunted apartment, cleansed it. Yet still, it seems the cleansing didn't always work. Miss Spencer returned. Talk to me a bit and share with the audience the story of Joan Rivers and that haunted apartment that she had.
Oh my God, I love that story. I was just randomly watching Celebrity Ghost Stories because this is what I do in my spare time. And I was like, Joan Rivers, I love her. I want to see her ghost story. So she apparently did live in a condominium on East 60th Street, 60th, 61st, Upper East Side. She lived in a condominium on the Upper East Side. And it was reputedly haunted by the ghost of a woman she dubbed Mrs. Spencer. And claimed she was the niece of J.P. Morgan. There's no actual facts to support this. And so she probably wasn't. Whoever this entity was, or whoever Joan thought she was, she probably was not J.P. Morgan's niece. But she may have been a woman who lived in that house. It was a, you know, fancy Gilded Age house. And there would have been like a kind of grand dame of the house, a doyenne of the house, Chatelaine. So it could have been her. Anyway, or it could have been just Joan's imagination. I don't know. I have no idea what Joan thought or felt or experienced in that house, but she said she felt that ghost. She did hire a woman who she termed in this, in all the media, she terms it as a quote, voodoo priestess. That's who she says it was. The woman's name was actually Sally Ann Glassman. And she was, though she was born Jewish, she was a practitioner of voodoo. And she's very active in her community, very active in the faith. And she lives in New Orleans. And so she was originally born in Maine. She lives in New Orleans now. So she came up to New York and she cleansed the apartment with Joan. And apparently they literally went around the whole building, knocking on people's doors at 2-3 in the morning, offering to cleanse their apartments too. And Joan says, nobody shut the door in our face, which is absolutely amazing. So anyway, as you said, the cleansing didn't take, the ghost returned. And Sally Ann said, listen, just appease her, give her fresh flowers every day, you know, kind of, you know, treat her as you would want to be treated as a lady, right? Mm-hmm. And so Joan, you know, and she had been recently widowed at this time in her life. This was a very difficult time in her life. And she was experiencing a lot of emotional turmoil. And she went from being sort of tormented by this spirit and her nightly visitations to accepting them and eventually embracing them, where, you know, it's like, ah, it's 3 a.m. Here's Mrs. Spencer's ghost again sitting by my bed. Well, hey, you know, cuddle up, girl. Let's hang out. And eventually they sort of became friends. And Joan felt a great deal of comfort in this ghost. And she started to, you know, ultimately find that this was kind of like a ghostly golden girls. Like it was sort of a companion. And then she also sort of developed this friendship with Sally Ann Glassman too, where she would like perform benefits for her. After Hurricane Katrina, Joan flew down to New York and performed benefits for Ms. Glassman's neighborhood in New Orleans. So, you know, they developed this beautiful friendship. And so I personally found the whole story really touching, really sweet, riddled with factual inaccuracies, but sweet nonetheless. And, ironically, I was like flipping through a book of Washington, D.C. ghost stories as I was researching that Mary Surratt chapter. And I found this really amazing parallel where there was a ghost in Washington, D.C., very similar, a woman who had died in a home and then started to visit the next lady of the house. And they sort of developed a friendship surrounding it. And again, I just saw this parallel. And I liked to sort of kind of play with the idea that maybe ghosts are not always terrifying. Maybe they offer a little bit of comfort and just this idea of the figure of the widow finding some sort of friendship beyond the grave, I thought was really sweet. So
has there been any reports of Joan Rivers as a ghost?
No, not that I know of. I feel like if she was a ghost, like she'd be pretty loud. You'd probably notice her. I don't think that Joan Rivers will haunt because a ghost cannot charge for her appearances. So she wouldn't. She wouldn't work for free, baby. Sorry.
Nice. That's nice. Lizzie Borden, I know we were talking about that earlier, but it is something I wanted to get to earlier, but it kind of slipped my mind as we got into other topics. It's a fascinating story, and I've been doing this show now for God knows how many years. And there, I would say earlier on, before paranormal tourism, if you will, really kind of got into something. And before every place was opening themselves up for ghost hunters and such to go in and investigate, the investigations that had been done on the Lizzie Borden house, I would say from the ones I had discussions on, many of them came back and said, we don't think there's anything there. It's a lot of lore. It's a lot of, you know, storytelling and such. But then suddenly investigators are going places and now it's, oh my gosh, this place has a lot of stuff going on in it. And some very good investigators that I've had on the show many times now say that. When you have a place like that, that has so much lore surrounding it, seemingly having been fairly quiet for a good deal of time, but then getting more active as more and more energy is focused in those directions. Mm-hmm. Does that itself, the energy, the thoughts, the curiosity from massive amounts of people, does that turn up the volume on a haunting, make it more active? Or does that, in effect, almost create a new haunting?
Oh, I like that question. Yeah, it is really interesting how there's not really a consensus on the Lizzie Borden house. But I love that theory that we do create the haunting. And I would just say off the cuff, yeah, that sounds really valid and really possible. I mean, it's the interaction between the human and the spirit that I think has a lot to do with it. So I think it's entirely possible. That being said, I do think there's a ton of resonance in that location. I mean, it is a murder scene And it does have that feeling about it, if you are open to less literal interpretations of haunting. But yeah, I wouldn't be surprised at all if like the energy that we bring to is sort of a cruise to that place. I would say that sounds really possible. What about you, Leanna? What do you think?
We really do kind of allow for some of the our sites that are, many of them are famous historical sites, even if the ghost, whoever might be said to be haunting a space, isn't necessarily famous if it's a well-known site, that just energy does accumulate through the years in any given, you know, in any given historic place, especially if it's a museum, especially if it's, you know, if it's a place that's trying to keep its doors open, it's going to lean into its ghost stories because it's going to lean into its ghost tourism because that is going to help a historic house keep its doors open. And so people do lend energy into it. It creates a bit of a feedback loop. And so where that falls in terms of paranormal experiences, well, it all is energy, really. And again, while we don't claim to say what these things are scientifically, we certainly do talk a lot in the book about how cultural memory and space and place memory will be contributing factors in how people feel a place, just sense a place might be haunted. And really, urban legend has a lot to do with perpetuating certain things, which, you know, we have some examples of things that are completely fabricated, that just became urban legends that were taken as truth and reported as true. And every place has one of, at least one of those. And then they become these sort of, there's sort of a word for this, tulpa, where it becomes a real thing, even though just by the power of our imagination and our energy, it becomes a real thing. And so I think that the more interest in a place will create something for better or for worse. But I always think that even if you're not remotely attuned to anything spectral, you can still visit a place where something either truly beautiful happened or something truly terrible happened and still appreciate the resonance of the history in and of itself. So the historic buildings are still always worth seeing and encountering because that is real. You are seeing that. You can touch that, those still extant stones. And so some of the actual tactile experiences outside of a sixth sense, you know, we're very interested in making sure we preserve historic structures. And those historic structures will absolutely have energies. And some, you know, curators and owners of those haunted places, how they choose to tell the stories they're in some cases can be kind of problematic. Like Andrea talks about in one of our chapters about the Sora Weed House in Savannah, Georgia, where that's a fabricated story. But there is a historic legacy of pain that's underpinning just the history there. So yes. So all this to say, yes, all of these things are true. We, again, are open to all interpretations of these things because, again, who are we to say? We don't know one way or another, and we may never know one way or another.
Yeah, the process of doing actual historical archival research on these stories has taught me that there are so many cold trails and so many dead ends, and there's so much that can never be known and can never be proven. So in a sense, all of these ghost stories, and I differentiate these from paranormal investigative research, energies, orbs, and so on. I'm saying these ghost stories, these narratives, these names, we are the ones giving them, naming them, constructing them, and retelling them. So in that sense, every ghost story is a creation of our own minds. Resurrection Mary in Chicago. Who is she? Well, some have theories, but at the end of the day, she is a whisper in the night. She's something that we talk about. She is an entity that we have manufactured in our consciousness. And those ghosts of the Sorrel Weed House, I do not believe they are literally the same ghosts that the tours tell you in the house right now. They do not align with those stories that are being told or the way they're told. But that doesn't mean there isn't something there. And I don't just mean like the soldiers who died of yellow fever. I mean, the ghosts that we create by talking about their stories. I found myself haunted by the notions of Francis Sorrell and Matilda and Molly as I was writing that book. And I did use the term tulpa in that chapter because I felt like I was, I called the chapter Willing the Ghosts to Life. I felt like I was creating them in the process of thinking them. And there was a manifest, a ship's manifest, that said an enslaved woman named Molly got on a ship on a certain date and came to New York City. And for a week, I just kept looking all around me on the subway and on the streets of Brooklyn, wondering, I wonder if one of your descendants is walking by me right now. You know, so it's like, this is the process of creation. And we're the ones who keep this alive.
That's very true. There's so many stories that are out there. Was there any that you wanted to fit into the book but didn't, and maybe are going to go into a volume two?
That's the hope. We literally just last week submitted a proposal package to our editor in hopes of a volume two, because, you know, we did not want this to be a compendium. We will never create an encyclopedic level of women's ghost stories. That's not really our focus. We want to still be writing about the things that's really specifically call to us, that we feel really compelled to tell the stories, but there's lots of them. We have multiple spreadsheets full of names.
so many color-coded spreadsheets.
Yes, absolutely. So we, and also too, it's interesting, you know, we did a national tour for this book, and it was lovely talking to some people in different areas. And so we've gotten questions like, what about the white lady in Connecticut? And so there's a Danbury, Connecticut white lady that's particularly famous. And so she's on the spreadsheet for book two, because we just didn't necessarily get a chance to get to everyone. And we won't necessarily get to everyone. I would love to do these for as long as Kensington will let us do them. But at the same time, we also have to feel that we have something to say about them. It was really fun collecting some names. There's definitely some very specific ghost stories whose names cropped back up that we were thinking about, whose names cropped back up on book tour. We both did a stint in St. Louis. And so it was the Lemp family. It's a very famous ghost mm-hmm. story out there. And so sure. By multiple requests, we're going to have to put that one in there. So in some cases, if folks want to lobby for a specific ghost, our social media is open for you to cast your votes on yeah. your famous lady ghost.
We're bursting with stories. We have so many more we want to tell. I feel like a child at bedtime. Just one yeah. more story. One more story.
Yeah.
There is an endless amount of ghost stories. I'll tell you that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, that's good. Cause it's what collectively brings us all together here talking about this stuff today. So it's just, and I think it really is. It's, you know, my chapter title for my introduction section is Existential Questions, because I really do think that, this is just the ongoing question of what is a ghost, and the many things that can mean, the many metaphors that can mean. It's just a source of endless fascination for me, because I don't really think we will ever quite get to the end of it. And frankly, I don't want to, because it is about living into the question that keeps me going. It really has been kind of my eternal flame since I was little, I think. And I'm sure this is resonant with all of your audience too, who comes to these things, because we are in some cases seekers of this, because we enjoy this sort of divine mystery.
That wraps up our conversation in full. If you would like to hear all of our episodes in their entirety, as well as bonus episodes, advanced episodes, and the entire archive, be a supporter of ours, a gravekeeper, as we call them, through Apple Podcasts. Even try it for 3 days free right now, or go to patreon.com/thegravetalks. Until next time, for all of us at The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.